Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, director of content at Steinway. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. This episode of Soundboard was recorded live from the Big Ears Festival, held each March in Knoxville, Tennessee. Go Vols! Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears. My guest today is musician and composer Nels Klein. Klein's career has embraced jazz and experimental music circles, yet he has also been the guitarist for the rock band Wilco since 2004 and was named by Rolling Stone magazine as one of the top 100 guitarists of all time. I saw Taj Mahal last night. He's playing with, there was steel drums, there was a bass, a lap steel guitar, but by a Hawaiian gentleman, so sort of Hawaiian vibes. And then the a drummer. The kit had 9 cymbals. I was like, wow.
That would be like my twin brother Alex's drum set. A lot of cymbals.
Does he have a full Rush-style kit?
He's really into not just cymbals, but gongs. And the cymbals include bell cymbals, which are this big to maybe this big. He doesn't do what a lot of drummers are doing now with these kind of two cymbals on top, dead or crashers or all that. He doesn't do much of that. He likes things that sustain.
Okay.
But he is a colorist with cymbals. That's why he's the, well, he's my identical twin brother, but he's also the only person that I wanted to play on my record called Lovers, which is an, you know, kind of orchestrated large ensemble record.
2016.
Because of his way to shade and express himself with not just cymbals, but drums, obviously, but that's part of his thing. And so it's not a, it's not visual, it's sonic, okay? It's not to look badass. It's just the way he likes it, and he does it brilliantly. I'm not super objective, he is my twin brother, but no, he's really, really good.
Shadings of cymbals and rides and crash and splash to you finding your voice. Because when I think of Nels Klein, I think of a musician who doesn't have a fixed voice because of your myriad projects. There's
so true.
There's a real space for different sounds and voices. So I wonder if those different projects and spaces are unified, if there's something that stays from project to project, if there's a line from, say, more accessible to more thorny, how do you navigate all of this?
It's a problem, but not not for me, for everybody else, I think, or others, perhaps. When people say they love my style, I have a question, which is, I have a style? I have a sensibility when I'm composing this or that and then putting a group together, or when I'm playing other people's music, I just try to honor what I think the music wants, which in my case isn't just this one voice or style, which many people accomplish and which seems to elude me. But honestly, I'm not trying for it in that way. Like a John Scofield, if you hear him play two notes, you know it's him. So I'm not one of those guys. But the thing that unifies them is generally the people doing the music, because I like them and they want me to play with them. And that's where I start making decisions based on their music or our chemistry or aesthetics that come naturally once we start improvising. I never had in my mind when I was a teenager and trying to figure out what I was doing, the idea that I would become versatile. In fact, quite the opposite. I was striving to be like people like John Abercrombie and like John McLaughlin and Ralph Towner and people who were identifiable with their styles, but whose music was not, it wasn't created for say social activities. So I was never the guy playing in bar bands. I never was the guy playing at weddings. And so I didn't learn a bunch of other people's music. The idea was that I was going to do my own music. And that's what I was doing in high school. I was doing instrumental music that drew upon the things that inspired me that I'd heard elsewhere, which in this case sort of started out with the Byrds and then psychedelia and Jimi Hendrix particularly and blues, and gradually drifted into jazz rock, electric jazz before the F word was created, and progressive rock. So people like Robert Fripp and Steve Howe and Peter Banks, this expanded my idea of what a guitar could do. And I later found out that it was kind of natural for me to alter the sound of the guitar with, now we say, effects pedals. And there's tons of this stuff now. But I could recreate sounds that were only possible in the recording studio prior to the invention of these boxes. Certainly Jimi Hendrix was somebody who utilized the studio, besides his own artistic vision and virtuosity on the instrument and as a songwriter and performer, obviously an electrifying performer. He used the studio as an instrument, as did the Beatles, and it became a thing. And this is what I thought I could do. And when I found out that I could do it with, well, it started with an Echoplex that a friend of mine left in my room, mm-hmm. that I started expanding my sonic vocabulary. And that created a whole other kind of dilemma, which was, should I be doing this? You know, am I a purist or am I not a purist? And that's all based on self-doubt and also on externalizing, imagining what other people are thinking. Because in reality, I was getting great pleasure out of these sounds, and it was not a big stretch for me. It was actually a natural occurrence, and much simpler for me than playing, you know, a jazz box straight into a polytone mini brute, which was more of a what I thought was a requirement in a way. So once I started down the path of multiple approaches to sound, then so did my stylistic things start changing. And so it had to do with the possibilities sonically, timbrally, and also the people whose music that I was endeavoring to play and what they either asked specifically for or what I could bring to it because they wanted me to come up with some stuff that fit their music. So this was now not just me playing my own music, you know? So for example, when I played on this record of Mike Watts called Contemplating the Engine Room, he had very, very specific ideas about what the guitar should be doing, but they weren't expressed in musical terms. They were metaphorical. So for he says propellers, bicycle wheels. He's talking about all these different things that had to do with the story he's telling with this brilliant conceptual work, in my opinion. So he wasn't telling me, like, here's a part, and then I learn the part, and I play the notes, and then that's the end of that. It really had to have a kind of signature, had to be a sonic signature that communicated what he was trying to communicate in sound terms, not in note terms, and not in words. And I think this is something I can do. Sometimes it's really challenging. You don't know what people are asking for. But I like trying to do that. And then with Wilco, I'm hearing in my head more like classic rock and roll kind of playing. Or I'm trying to play this country style song. And I'm in my head, I'm hearing Clarence White. And I'll never be able to play like Clarence White. But I have my tourist version or my wannabe version. And suddenly, once again, I'm in sort of versatility terrain. And this was not my goal.
What wasn't your goal?
Versatility. Yeah, I wanted to just be able to play, I guess, kind of, it doesn't mean I wouldn't use effects, you know, like Robert Fripp, he used fuzz and a volume pedal. Steve Howe was a big influence, and he was playing slide, he's playing with volume pedal, he has distortion, he has delay. This appealed to me orchestrally and became kind of natural for me to do, but how it eventually applied to moving forward, it was just going to be in my own music, like I was saying before. And I realized, I guess, sort of in spite of myself, that I could apply this to other types of styles of music, like Wilco songs, Jeff Tweedy songs. By then I was kind of almost 50 years old, so I'd kind of been doing it for a while. But it became still a challenge, a challenge to make the sound seemingly, I don't know, legit's a terrible word, but to make it ring true and make it fit the song, make it honor the song.
True, that's a good way to put it. Early in my, let's call it my music criticism career, I realized that the question isn't, is this good, is this bad? It's, is this convincing? Does this feel authentic within what it was? So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that you have this pursuit of authenticity, and if that requires a different sound or a different tone or a different approach, you're willing to make that to suit the environment of the music that's being created.
Yeah, and that the person who wrote the music is pleased. In my own music, I have ideas about it, but I'm not, you know, you have this kind of romantic vision of the tormented artist,
right,
painting a canvas and then burning it out,
right,
of frustration. So no, I don't do that. I may not be happy, well, I'm generally not happy with the guitar solos, but I'm generally pleased with the aesthetic overall and the compositions and the band. Otherwise, I guess I wouldn't release it, but but they're not calculated to be part of a long arc of a story about my so-called aesthetics or my legacy or anything. It's just me putting one foot in front of the other. But when it comes to someone else's music and they're giving me direction, I just want to do what they want to do, what they're hoping I will do.
Mm-hmm. So there's a difference between when it's your own project and when you're a sideman of sorts.
Yeah. 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 I mean, some people, when I'm a sideman, they just want what they think is my thing. But quite often what they think is my thing is really another idea. And I don't care. I don't care. I want to do what they want, you know? And a lot of times they don't know what they want. And so we go back and forth and we try things and it's fun. And quite often, I mean, it can be a little laborious and frustrating, I suppose.
But that's working musician mode.
Yeah.
And I'm here to fit this plan.
On a Jeff Tweedy song, he might have an idea of what he thinks I can do on the song, but it might take us a while to get to the place where we're both thinking like, well, that's cool, because he said to me many times that I'm too reverent coming into a song that he's written, kind of tiptoeing in and like, if the song has a certain thing, I say, hey, maybe we'll play a little lap steel on this. And in reality, hours later or days later, I might be, you know, walking on the guitar with four fuzz boxes on or something, which is obviously an exaggeration, but something not so far from that will satisfy whether it's the idea that he has or the idea that he got along the way, or he wants to subvert the song in some way. And we arrive at that from trial and error and discussion. And quite often I end up doing something I did not expect to be doing.
You referred just a minute ago to this laborious process, and I think we're talking about the process of creating a song or working on a tune. I'd love to hear how that unfolds for you.
Well, it's different in a rock band, a notable rock band, than it is in my own music, because participating in a long-standing rock and roll thing, I tend to feel like there's some kind of idea that the wheel needs to be reinvented all the time. And I don't struggle with that idea in my own music and my own projects. And I don't have the time to do it, honestly, because we make our records in 2 days, maybe three. And we're capturing performances, which Wilco does also, but not always. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are demos made, and then there's this, and then there's some rearranging, and then there's the searching and the overdubbing and all the different things that happen over a long period of time. And honestly, I work fast generally, and so I like to stay working fast. Mm-hmm. So the reinventing the wheel thing can be a bit much for me. So I'm really just looking to get a good performance in my own stuff, or if I'm playing a so-called jazz record, that's what everybody's doing. And we can go in and fix little mistakes, or we can even edit or do something later with today's computer technology. So it's not quite as stressful as recording, say, straight to tape but without even mixing, which I've certainly done. And I've even mixed records live to tape for my friends. I like that. I like that immediacy, you know? Mm-hmm. And then if I don't like what we did, I kind of either have to just get rid of the song for that particular recording, or you have to start over and call another session or something. Mm-hmm. That's a little too luxurious. So that doesn't usually happen. I can kind of do it now. Like on this new record of mine, Concentric Quartet, I did want to add two pieces to the album.
Is this with Tom and Ingrid?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and
gotcha.
Tris, yeah. I did want to add these two songs, just content, vibe, whatever. It just seemed like it needed something else, and I wrote these pieces. So months later, we called a one-day session, and we were done, you know, 3 or 4 hours. Mm. And I'm happy, but we didn't play any of the other songs over again. In the case of Current's Constellations, the so-called Nels Klein 4, or the NC4, as I like to call it, I recorded the songs kind of as demos. And also, you know, I produce my own stuff, and then I play it for Don Was, and he says, great. And I think, oh, okay, I'm going to make another Blue Note record. Well, that's cool. So in the case of that record, I wanted to add more, because I only recorded a few things to see if the vibe was cool for him, if everyone at Blue Note was going to be excited about it or whatever. But I also re-recorded two of the songs because I wanted the improvising to go into some different areas, a little freer, a little less kind of directly related to the writing, to the composing. So I re-recorded two of the songs, but that's only because I was recording two more new songs. I had that luxury, but that was 3 days. So it's usually to get to a different balance in terms of the dynamics, at what use of space, note choices, something. It's not to rewrite the piece or rearrange the piece.
Has there been a discovery or discoveries over the years of doing this that made you change your approach?
It depends on the project. Mm-hmm. In the case of Concentric Quartet, we had played this piece on it called The Bag. It's a piece dedicated to Tom Rainey, in fact.
with his extended technique of paper bags,
right,
on the drums.
Which, now that I've called a tune the bag, he never does that now, by the way.
You shamed him out of this practice.
No, everyone loves it. He probably just didn't want to
It's his signature move.
Yeah, he just probably didn't want people to think it was shtick, right? I don't know. We never discussed it after that. I kind of want to bring it up at some point, like, what happened to the bag? But anyway, so I have a solo, and I'm you know, increasingly uncomfortable soloing instead of more comfortable as I've gotten older.
Wait, why is that?
Because I'm neurotic.
Okay.
I think. I can't explain it. It's just, I don't know, you know, not particularly pleased hearing myself solo. So there's a section where it goes to this kind of like E7 sharp 11 thing with this vamp in 7/8 as part, after Ingrid and Tom, I wrote in a free duet for them. Just basically like exploiting their duo,
right,
which I find marvelous. And obviously they're very close. So after that, Chris and I are playing these cued odd meter ostinati, I guess you'd say. And then we go into the 7/8 thing in like the E7 sharp 11. And so when we were playing it live, I was kind of playing heavy, distorted lead guitar. And we recorded that song with me doing that, and I just hated it. Mm. So I reapproached the solo, and I basically do the whole solo as a in and out looping thing, live looping thing with my 16-second digital delay. And I'm pleased now, you know? And I don't know, we're about to go do a little micro tour, and I don't know exactly how I'm going to approach that section, if I'm going to be like, oh, let's reproduce what I did on the record, or if I'm going to actually go back to trying to play a more linear and more conventional approach. I don't actually know. But I did, for the recording, shift direction and changed my strategy to essentially please myself. It sounds pretty cool. And it's also shorter, which is good. It's concise.
I think pleasing yourself can be shorthand for, this is what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and honestly, sometimes I go back. There are a bunch of things that I've done that I don't listen to, maybe once in a blue moon. But there are other things I kind of return to, because it gives me kind of a little bit of confidence that I'm not maybe having that day or something. And I think, wow, I hit the nail on the head with this. And it's not about the soloing or even the improvising as often as it is about the composition. And I think, wow, that was worth doing, because every time I hear it, I kind of think, I did a good thing here. And I'm doing it, obviously, because I'm getting this reaction from my own music. but that to me is success, because I've experienced it repeatedly with the same piece. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and that to me is, you know, I feel like I might get some sort of immersive, transcendent experience out of this, listening to this. And that's, I want really to be kind of my gift to the culture, if I have one, besides just playing live and being in real time with great players expressing themselves and liking the music they're playing. Because most of the music I write, and I'm considering myself a prolific composer at all, and I don't think my compositions are important, but I want to honor the players. I want them to like the music and feel that their voice can come through, and that we can collectively sculpt it and change it if necessary, or maybe even change it in real time on a stage. And so the combination of this, what I call like fascistic didactic factor of do this and our heads will explode, is there on some pieces. And generally, I think the only head that explodes is mine. And that's usually kind of far down the road. But that's a satisfying feeling. But in the moment, I want everybody to just participate. And I'm thinking of their voices as instrumentalists and hoping that I honor those voices and they can basically take over or change the music if necessary. And I will change with them. The possibility of that is kind of exhilarating if you think about it.
And that brings us full circle, right? With these different voices, you're speaking of this gift to the culture of honoring and amplifying voices.
Yeah, yeah. There are certain ways that it sounds like I'm being self-effacing or something when I say this, or maybe just kind of poking fun at myself. But I do see myself at this point in my life, and I'm 69 years old now, as being kind of an old hoofer, you know what I mean? Or a vaudevillian. In the sense that I'm just going to go down with the live music in small venues ship, just like an off Broadway kind of thing, and just be wanting to do that. I'm really just kind of old school, is what I'm saying, and the vaudevillian part to me is the set list. It's the ride, you know, the journey for the audience. Really, not just for the players, not just for me. I really want to present variety in terms of dynamics, tempos, mood. I want it to take people somewhere and arrive potentially, ostensibly, at some cool place where you'd feel somehow nourished or excited or maybe just dizzy and disoriented, you know, rather than it be some dry exercise. Or just monolithic, you know, or monotonous. You know, I really strive for a balanced and varied program, which I think might be a little bit entertainment mind, but I've always been like this. In spite of all the noise, you know, in spite of all the strident, teeth gnashing type of sounds, those sounds are kind of transporting for me, and I realize they're not for everybody. So there is a kind of indulgence that comes along with all this, or pretension, you know. But doesn't, I don't know, I've never looked this up, but doesn't pretentious mean you're pretending that someone else gives a damn and that it's like not just important to you, but it's important to somebody else? So I have no trouble with pretension, because otherwise, I mean, how do we make that leap? Then you just stay in your bedroom and just say like, well, this isn't good enough for the world. I can't do that. I want to get out and play in the world so I can just be playing that kind of music. I had somebody many, many years ago in the late 80s, well, two musicians kind of brace me at a rehearsal and say, like, you and your, let's just not mention any names, but are your improviser, free jazz, whatever. Why do you guys think your music is good enough to put out on records? You know, it's not Coltrane, you know, it's not Miles, it's not, you know, and it's like, man, were you guys alive in the 70s when people were putting out solo snare drum records? You know, I mean, it's just, they just want to do their own music. We want to do our own music. And if this is our calling card in a way, we want to get more gigs. We were putting on our own shows. You know, we didn't have some big following and people paying attention to what we were doing, and we wanted to further it. And so it wasn't staking a claim on our own brilliance. It was saying, hey, you might like this, and with any luck, we'll play more if people hear it, you know, and we'll get better. I didn't do music with this group, Quartet Music, for 11 years, the acoustic group, and, you know, saying as much as we were inspired, very inspired by Oregon, the band Oregon, and Miles Quintet with Herbie and Wayne and Ron and Tony, all these, and we're not saying like, and check us out, we're as good as that, you know, that wasn't it at all. The idea was, well, we stand by this music, but that's it. We just like it. This is how we write. This is how we play. We're striving all the time. You know, that's enough for me, from any artist. Thank you.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Beautiful Love from Nels Klein's album Lovers on Blue Note Records. Two notes from John Scofield's A Go-Go from the eponymously titled album on Verve. From Impossible Journey on Sky Blue Sky and from Everlasting Everything on Wilco the album, both by Wilco on Nonesuch. And from The Bag on Nels Klein's Concentric Quartet on Blue Note Records. Our opening music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush on a Steinway Model M, played by me, Ben Fanan. Our closing music is 23 from Nels Klein's Concentric Quartet on Blue Note. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard, message me on Facebook at Steinway, or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears Festival. Thank you for listening.